house or a wild child can have an eye language or use an eye language?
Well, the wild child question is an interesting one. It has to do with critical periods. The question is whether there's a... I mean, most biological systems that we know about, in fact, maybe all, have to develop at a certain stage, you know. So like, say, developing binocular vision in humans has to happen around 4 months old, I think. And if it's delayed too long, like if you don't have visual stimulation, it just won't happen. And it can't happen before that. I mean, there's a little variation, but more or less like that. If you do this experimentally, let's say you take a pigeon and you, I don't remember the numbers anymore, but so I'll make them up, but if you keep it in a box for, say, 2 weeks after birth and then let it out, it'll fly. You know, all the stuff that went on up till then didn't really matter. It was just incipient motions, not learning. On the other hand, if you keep it in the box till, say, 4 weeks, it'll never fly. The same is apparently true. I mean, you don't do these experiments with humans, obviously, but sometimes it's like a natural experiment. I mean, a kid is brought up in, you know, a splint or something for some reason. If it's too long, like, I don't know, two or three years, the kid probably will never learn to walk. If it's, say, 18 months, the kid will be walking normally in almost no time. Well, that's the way things usually work. Does it work that way with language? Well, there's indirect evidence that there is a period, roughly from birth up till, you know, somewhere pre-puberty, where everything's going on, and probably different things are going on at different periods. Like I think I mentioned the other day, an awful lot of the phonology apparently is established before you even pronounce anything, 6 months old, say. It's well known, but it's known surprisingly by now that a good deal of the phonology is sort of fixed by about 6 months, and other things are fixed whenever they're fixed. Okay, then comes the question: what would happen if we had something comparable to the pigeon raised in the box, or the kitten deprived of visual stimulation? And that's the wild child situation. Well, again, you don't do experiments, so you look at the natural experiments. The natural experiments rarely tell you anything. And the reason they rarely tell you anything is that when you find a child who's been severely deprived, the child is so psychotic, you know, so many things are going wrong that you don't know what, you can't pick out the language part. The most carefully studied case of this is a case of Jeannie, which maybe you've seen, the girl to whom they gave the name of Jeannie, who was found in Los Angeles. She was locked in a room in an attic, tied to a chair. Her parents were completely insane, you know. And they had kept her in this room, tied to a chair, apparently without any verbal stimulation, all her life, you know. They kept her alive by pushing in pieces of food, which she'd pick up and eat and so on. And that's how she lived up till, I think, the age of 13. Well, you know, she was discovered by some social worker or something, so they obviously took her away. Put her in a hospital and tried to do various things. And one of the therapists, a woman named Susan Curtis, was a linguist, a student of Vicky Fromkin's at UCLA. And she began kind of she was working mainly as a therapist. I mean, the main thing was to try to help the child, you know. So it was mainly therapy. But in the course of the therapy, she tried to see what kind of linguistic ability she could pick up, because, of course, they tried to teach her language just so she could get around. Well, it turned out that Jeannie was extremely bright by, say, IQ tests and things like that. And immediately she could do all sorts of things. So she could do sorting experiments. You know, you sort things by color and shape and so on. She'd never seen anything, you know. She'd just seen the walls of the room, you know. But she could quickly, immediately, without any training, do complicated sorting things. She could make all kinds of complex categorizations. It turned out she had all kinds of musical interests. Susan Curtis happens to be a very good pianist. And Jeannie, of course, was so psychotic that she was always having fits and this and that. And she found that one of the ways to calm her down was to start playing the piano. But it turned out that only certain musical genres would work, you know, like Romanian folk dances, you know, and not some other thing, which means that she was able to distinguish musical genres, and not only distinguish them, but they had different meaning for it. Although she'd never heard any music all her life. So she had all kinds of abilities, and she was a very appealing kid. She was very pretty, first of all, and just very kind of appealing, and she just made people do things for her, and she fooled people into thinking she was doing all kinds of things she wasn't doing because they got kind of seduced by her, sort of. And for a long time, and she was able to do it. She knew how to do it very fast. It was kind of amazing to read the description. I never saw her, but just reading the descriptions or listening to, I talked to Susan Curtis at length once about it. And for a while, they thought she was learning language. And the early results, this would be a case of a wild child, you know, well-studied case. She was doing something that looked like very much like language, and she was smart enough so that she was able to get people to believe that she was talking language. But when they began to look more carefully, they found it wasn't language. It was something that had some superficial resemblance to it, but never had the properties of language. You know, it never had grammatical structure, you know, all kinds of things it just didn't have. And she was clever enough and appealing enough and, you know, knew how to manipulate people well enough so that she could get them to think that she was talking language and often communicate with them. But when you began to look closely, it seemed there was a barrier she could never get across. Well, does that mean that she had passed the critical period? Well, it could mean that, or it could mean that she was so screwed up that something else was wrong. I mean, she ended up, the end result was very unhappy. After a period of improvement, she began to decline, and she ended up in a kind of vegetable state.
If the language doesn't form, and there wasn't no generative procedure that she could use to formulate the medical rules, the maintenance system.
It doesn't say anything. For one thing, we don't know. The only thing that's known about Jeannie is she didn't get an eye language. Now, whether this is because the critical period had been passed or whether it's because of something else in her complex makeup, nobody can tell. Remember, you know, if a kid lives for 13 years under those conditions, they're going to be very psychotic. And that it's like, you know, it's like trying to learn something about the brain by hitting it with a battering ram and seeing what's left, you know. I mean, you might learn something, but it's not a good experiment. So you can't really tell a lot about what happened. But there is, suppose it's true that she was past the critical period. Well, that would just tell you language is innate. I mean, just we know similar things about other systems where you can do experiments. I mean, we allow ourselves to torture cats and monkeys. Okay, so therefore there's a lot of information about cats and monkeys. And it's known that cats and monkeys, I mean, you can't test the language faculty because they don't have one, but you can test the visual system, say, or the auditory system or whatever, and a lot is known. In the case of kittens, say, monkeys are about the same. If you keep a kitten's eyes sewed shut from infancy up to some period, I forget how long, I think it's a few weeks, maybe somebody remembers, a couple of weeks, then they never learn to see. And there's actual physical degeneration of the visual cortex. You know, you do, by now a lot's known about how the visual cortex works, and there actually is disintegration of the cortical structures that would have been involved in perception if you keep a kitten in blindness for several weeks. In fact, it even turns out that if you deprive a kitten of pattern stimulation, the same thing happens. So they do experiments in which they cover a kitten's eyes with a ping pong ball. Does that mean anything? Yeah, okay. With a ping pong ball, you know, so you get light coming through, but no structure. You just get diffuse light. Well, that also causes the visual system to disintegrate. So it apparently is the case that pattern stimulation is required to get the system going. And if you go too long, it stops. Well, what does that tell us about innateness? Well, you know, it tells us that that's the way the innate system is determined. The innate system has its very special structure. It picks out lines and angles and motion. It does all those things. But it's not going to do it unless at a certain stage of life it gets a trigger that says, do it. Now, the trigger doesn't tell it how to do it. It does it the way it's designed. The trigger's like turning on the ignition in your car. You know, your car is designed in such a way that when you turn on the ignition, you know, the motor goes. It's not that the motor learned how to go by looking at the ignition. Okay, and it's the same with every system of the body, as far as we know. They all need certain triggers to do what they're supposed to do. Then they do their own thing. The language system is probably like that. The only reason we can't say anything for sure about it is there's no way to experiment. Now, actually, the best evidence about this that I know of, since you can't experiment, you have to be clever about it, you know, and there's a lot of clever studies. The best stuff that I know of is by Alyssa Newport, who's a psycholinguist in Rochester, and who's been working for a long time in sign language. Sign language works like ordinary language, but it's a better thing to study because you can control the input much better. I mean, there's so much spoken language going around that you haven't the slightest idea what anybody has heard. Okay, but in the case of sign language, the communities are often quite restricted, so you can get a good sense of what information has come to the child, let's say. Okay, well, she studied people who had learned sign language, deaf people who had been taught sign language at different ages. I think the ages were something like, you know, 5, 10, and maybe 20 or something. And she studied them all 30 years after they had learned the language. So they were, say, 35, 40, and 60, or something like that, 50, okay. So they'd all had about the same exposure, and they'd been in roughly the same kinds of communities of users. So you could assume that they were essentially comparable with regard to experience. They only differed with regard to the onset of learning. And then what she did was study the level of competence achieved. And there was a considerable difference. The ones who had had 30 years of experience from 5 years old were perfect signers, indistinguishable from the best signers. The ones at 10 years old had some defects. The ones at 20 years old had quite serious deficiencies. Not that they couldn't communicate. You know, there's all kind of ways of overcoming deficiencies. It's just that they didn't really know nuances of the language. Actually, it's very surprising what you don't know. For example, this man I mentioned, Morris Halley, who's my oldest personal friend. We've known each other for 45 years. He came to the United States when he was 15, so that's pretty early. And his English is perfectly fluent, you know, knows everything. But when we started to do linguistics together, he began to discover that there are things about English that he just doesn't know. You know, you'd never find it out in ordinary life. You wouldn't even find it out in reading literature. It's just when you start worrying about these crazy exotic issues, you know, that linguists are trying to figure out, that he realized he just didn't have intuitions where everybody else did. You know, well, okay, that's from learning language at 15. You know, and that's it's the same as Alyssa Newport was able to show it experimentally. And that is evidence for a critical period. It's indirect evidence, but evidence for a critical period. To get tighter evidence will be hard, but only because of the difficulty of carrying out experiments. I mean, if we were able, you know, if we allowed ourselves, you know, if we were a bunch of Nazi doctors, say Mengele or something like that, we could answer all these questions very fast, because it's obvious what kind of experiments to do. Right. There's one case. There's one very interesting case of it was studied by some students of Lila Gleitman's. What's her name? I forgot her name. Anybody remember? It was a student of Lila Gleitman's who found, they found, what they found was, it'll come back to me, they found in Philadelphia, where these people are, they found a family where the parents had normal hearing, but there were a couple of children who were deaf. I don't know, some congenital thing or whatever. Maybe they had meningitis or something. There were a couple of children who were deaf, and they were cousins, so they spent a lot of time together, and they were isolated. Now, at that period, there was a kind of an ideology in treatment of the deaf at one time that said you shouldn't teach them sign language. It'll harm them. You know, it's called the oralist tradition. And in fact, it was held very firmly. You should prevent children from signing. You know, not just don't teach them sign language, but don't allow them to sign. Because the idea is they have to learn lip reading. And it's like minority languages. You know, you got to learn the majority language. You're not allowed to learn them in a minority language. It's about the same logic. And there's some very interesting things about this. Actually, there's a school, a well-known school for the deaf in the Boston area, where this was, you know, the firmly held ideology. Now, the first person who studied any of this stuff is a guy who died about 15 years ago named Eric Lenneberg. We were grad students together. And back in around the 1950s, he started investigating these questions. And he went to this school, it was Perkins School for the Deaf, it was called. And he discovered something quite interesting that nobody in the school knew. Namely, all the kids were signing. I mean, as soon as the teacher would look back to the board, you know, instead of the kids whispering to each other, they'd start signing to each other. And then when the teacher turned around, you know, they'd put their hands down. So the teachers had no idea that the kids knew how to sign, you know, but they all knew how to sign. And they hadn't, nobody had taught them, you know, they just learned from the last kids there or something like that. So there was a whole signing culture that had gone on forever, you know, and none of the adults knew about it. I mean, it's as if, you know, like maybe under Franco, people were talking Catalan when the teacher wasn't listening or something. That kind of thing. It's analogous to that. Well, this particular case that was studied closely was three kids whose parents had been heavily indoctrinated with the idea that they're not allowed to sign. In fact, it was so extreme that the parents had been taught by the experts that they shouldn't even gesture. You know, like don't point to things or, you know, don't do the normal things you would do with a child. You know, like hold your hands in your pockets all the time. So the kids had never been exposed to any sign. That was pretty certain. And what was discovered when they were about 3 years old was that they had invented a sign language. You know, they had just invented their own sign language from zero, no evidence. It's the paper on it is called Beyond Herodotus. You know, Herodotus tells a story about some, you know, pharaoh who wanted to know what the original language was. So he put a couple of kids off in some island somewhere to see what they would start talking. And they started talking Phrygian, according to this story. So they decided that Phrygian was the original language. But so this is Beyond Herodotus. Susan Golden Meadow is the woman who worked on it. Golden Meadow, yeah, sorry. They of course studied. I mean, they immediately started teaching them regular sign language, of course, you know, the obvious reasons. But there's a period in there when they could study what they knew, and what they had developed was a pretty normal natural language. That was kind of ergative language, actually, and it had normal properties. They had roughly the kind of expected sentence length and complexity for kids of that age, and very much a normal language with normal linguistic properties, but developed from zero evidence. It's kind of interesting to compare that with the Genie case. These kids had triggers. They were giving each other the triggers. And that was enough to set the thing off. The evidence is kind of converging, you know, to saying that some stimulation is necessary to get the thing going. It then goes in the normal way, but it doesn't need any external inputs. I mean, here's a case of language knowledge on the basis of literally zero evidence. The perfect case. It's the only case known like that.
Another case.
Invented at some time, yeah. Yeah, that's true. If you go back far enough, there must have been some point when some... Well, actually, that's not... Yeah, it's not so obvious, actually. I mean, what we'd have to know is... I'm not sure the answer, how far back sign language goes. See, the point is that people are often unaware that sign language exists, as in the School for the Deaf case. Hearing people are often unaware that sign language exists. Deaf people are usually subjected to one or another kind of prejudice. So they're a community that's subject to repression. And therefore, what's going on inside those communities, you may not know. You know, so for example, for a long time, it was assumed that American blacks are often totally unintelligible. I mean, in the area of Philadelphia where I lived, it was right at a block between a white area and a black area. And when I was on, say, a trolley car, and a kid from two blocks over was sitting behind me talking, I couldn't understand one word, you know. It was, they were talking some totally different language. And for a long time, it was assumed that that was some very restricted code, you know. You couldn't only say, you know, you could only grunt a few things or something. It wasn't until fairly, disgracefully recently, the last 20 or 30 years, that people really came to what any sane person should have known, that, of course, it's a rich language like anything else. Now, there are all kinds of things going on in repressed communities that one simply may not know about just because of racism or discrimination or whatever. And the deaf have always been a repressed community. So we simply don't know whether they've always had sign language or not.